For almost 2,000 years, the Catholic Church has pointed the way toward salvation through Jesus Christ. For each of us, that journey starts in darkness, as if in a cave. We invite you now to come with us as we seek wisdom and truth by way of faith and reason with your guides, Mark Tuttle and Timothy O'Donnell. Join us in the Catholic Cave. Welcome once again to the Catholic Cave. I'm Kent Blanford. In the cave with me, Mr. Mark Tuttle, Mr. Timothy O'Donnell. Gentlemen, today we are going to be speaking about culture.
High culture?
No, low, low culture.
No, we got to deal with something. Medium? We got to deal with something we can, you know, actually get our hands around. And so we are going to be dealing with pop culture.
Oh, like soda pop. Excellent.
Pop culture.
Now, more, love a good Diet Coke.
Well, you know, a good Coke goes along with a good movie.
Yes. Yeah. Ah, I love talking about films.
Exactly. You know,
let's do it.
Right. I recently, just this past weekend, went out to the theaters and saw the movie Gosnell.
Me too.
So, yeah, I highly recommend if it's still in the theaters by the time we air, which it may or may not be, because, you know, this particular film, it's done well at the box office. But the question is to whether it's done well enough to kind of have some staying power at the theaters.
But that's why we have to go out and see if it's still available.
Yeah, and if it's not available in the theaters when it comes out on DVD or when it's available at Redbox or someplace like that, I highly recommend seeing it. And you know, it's a great example. It's obviously a powerful film from a pro-life perspective, but I think it's a great example of the potential of what film can do. You know, it's a compelling backstory, but it's able to, I think, provide a kind of moral universe. It allows us to kind of step back a little bit from some of the headlines. It's a real life story, but it allows us to get some distance for our judgment to kick in, for us to kind of analyze what's going on, and really for us to kind of think about one of the bigger issues in the world today, and that's abortion.
Yeah, and that's one of the benefits of film. Film is the sort of these mega narratives that and stories that we're telling, that we tell ourselves. And a film like a Gosnell draws much needed light to a horrific tragedy of what Kermit Gosnell is. I think arguably is the most effective film billed as. He's the most prolific killer in American history.
Right.
And people do not know his name in the way that they know other names mass killers.
You know, and the film kind of, you know, it focuses on his trial. It's really a courtroom drama. So
yes.
It focuses on the trial, so it doesn't necessarily focus on all of the victims. So he was put on trial for, I think, 3 babies that he had killed. But the number of babies that they think he killed is like 70 or 80. I mean,
I might even say it's even probably higher than that. It's hard to put a finger on it. But he, I guess what I would say too about the film Gosnell is, in that sort of court, it is of the highest quality. Sometimes in these different circles, you hear pro-life film, and I would say it's secondarily. It's not really. I wouldn't bill it as a pro-life film. I would bill it as, like you said, a kind of a courtroom drama about a mass killer, and almost like a docudrama. But what's different about this compared to some of the other films that I've seen is just the quality is so much better. The way the storyline is put together. They're high caliber actors throughout that do a terrific job. In fact, the actor who plays, and I've done a lot of research on Gosnell, I've seen YouTube of him and stuff. The person who plays him is just a phenomenal actor. I mean, it's a very realistic portrayal. And so throughout the film, I think, is a remarkable achievement in terms of quality of production, storytelling, etc.
Yeah, it's a very well-written movie, and that was what jumped out to me. And that's kind of, in my opinion, what sets it apart from some of these other pro-life movies is the writing behind it. They got top-notch writers involved in it, and the story, it's a very gripping story because they make it a courtroom drama about the trial.
Yeah, and I think that's what we should do, Mark, is We should bring in a guest to kind of talk about film. And, you know, film has such an important influence on pop culture, as Kent talked about. That's what we're going to be talking about in today's program. So coming up here after we take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to have a special, I would say, I don't want to say guest, I want to say more of an honorary cave dweller himself. Dr. Jason Eberl is going to join us, and we're going to explore the filmography of writer, director, producer Christopher Nolan as a big theme to today's show. So stay tuned.
You know us as Catholic Radio Indy, but we're so much more than just radio. We're a website, CatholicRadioIndy.org, with access to great Catholic resources, including podcasts of all our local programming, podcasts that have been downloaded from all 50 states and over 40 countries on 6 continents. Yes, we are Catholic Radio Indy, but thanks to your support, we're taking the gospel of Christ to the ends of the earth. Catholic Radio Indy and CatholicRadioIndy.org.
And welcome back to the Catholic Cave. Joining us once again is an honorary member of the Catholic Cave, Dr. Jason Eberl, who is the professor of healthcare ethics at St. Louis University. Some of you listening, regular listeners to the Cave, remember Jason when he was here in Indianapolis at Marion University. He's also the author and editor of numerous books. I don't know, how many books are you up to now, Dr. Eberl?
Well, in terms of the pop culture stuff, I've done 6 now.
Oh, wow. Fantastic. What about more on the academic scholarly side? Oh, seven. See, it's hard for me to keep track, too.
in terms of my academic research, I've written 2 books and edited a 3rd collection.
Oh, fantastic. So we're interested in kind of talking about pop culture this time. So we're going to, I know you're an expert on both sides, both on the healthcare ethics side, but also pop culture. And I think today's program, we're probably going to spend our time on the pop culture side because there's a variety of different, the importance of culture, I don't think can be understated. One of the ways that I think we can begin to understand the culture in which we live are these sort of mega narratives that we tell ourselves through things like film. I know one filmmaker who is very prominent. A lot of his work, our listeners will be familiar with, is Christopher Nolan. And I know you published a book about a year ago, a collection of essays on the philosophy of Christopher Nolan. So maybe tell us a little bit about, you know, why take on that project? Why look at the work of a director, writer, producer, Christopher Nolan?
It's a project that I did with a colleague of mine, George Dunn, and he and I used to teach a course at IUPUI together in the summers on philosophy through pop culture, and we used various pop culture media, and a couple of Nolan's films were kind of always part of our repertoire, kind of his early breakout film, Memento, and then one of the movies from his Dark Knight trilogy, the Batman trilogy. And so we're like, you know, people have done books on Batman and books on Inception, another one of Nolan's films.
Oh, yeah. But
you look at his work as a whole, there's not only a lot of interesting philosophical depth in each film, but there's kind of an overarching theme of his works, which is a lot of about defining one's selfhood, about self-abnegation, about the nature of society and kind of the bonds that hold us together. And so, yeah, George and I wanted to do this book to kind of not only touch on each of his individual films, but draw out these larger themes. He's definitely got an overall message he's communicating to his audience.
So let's pick one. Maybe let's start with, say, the Dark Knight trilogy, Batman series. And that series has been rebooted multiple times. And I got to tell you, my experience watching the Dark Knight trilogy by Christopher Nolan was quite a contrast to the 60s television series that I used to watch growing up with, who was it, Adam West, I think?
Right. And
those ridiculous costumes.
Yeah, and it's a contrast even with Michael Keaton as Batman, too.
Oh,
I
mean,
it's a totally different.
That's another bomb.
Totally different cast on the character, that's for sure.
What's the project? So maybe tee it up a little bit for us, if you would, Dr. Mm-hmm. Eberle, about what is Nolan up to with Dark Knight?
So the Dark Knight, of course, is the second film in that trilogy, and introduces the major villain throughout Batman's constant arch nemesis, the Joker, played by the late Heath Ledger, and that film actually raises a lot of different stuff. When we teach in class, one of the things we focus on is the sort of dilemma that gets raised in the film about human nature and seeking self-preservation. The Joker throughout the film keeps saying that people don't really know who they are, and that's kind of his job, is to introduce a little bit of anarchy in order to tease out how humans will behave in a sort of state of nature, right? Mm. Where kind of the normal rules of society break down or are no longer applicable. And, will they, listen to their better angels or to the devils on their shoulder?
And I think throughout that film, you begin to see Batman himself. That's one of the central struggles to his character, right? Is he's Bruce Wayne, and he's Batman at the same time, and that creates a kind of I don't want to say identity crisis, but maybe that is what's going on there.
Well, identity crises are definitely one of the hallmarks of Nolan's film. As I said earlier, kind of these themes of selfhood and self-identity and a duplication of the self, so that even to the point where oneself can be divided against oneself, is a constant theme throughout his films. And so, I think that's one reason he wanted to take on, the Batman stories, because, there's this intrinsic duality of Bruce Wayne and Batman. And so, for example, in the film, the film's old enough that I'll go ahead and give spoilers. And
okay, fair warning.
I've seen it by now. But, in the film, Batman's, close friend and, someone he's in love with but is not able to be in a relationship with, Rachel, is killed by the Joker. And for both Batman and for her current boyfriend, Harvey Dent, this kind of pushes them to the edge. So the Bruce Wayne side of Batman is, in love with Rachel and is torn up about her death. As Batman, though, he has an absolute rule of not to kill. He's a vigilante, but he's a vigilante for justice. And the Joker tells him, you will have to break your one rule. And that's kind of the question throughout the film. Will the Joker push Batman enough that he'll violate this sort of one moral absolute of his?
Yeah, and throughout that creates a tremendous amount of tension throughout the film. When we think about the trilogy kind of overall, give us kind of like a summary or an overarching theme to the entire trilogy of, I guess I would call it Dark Knight, but it starts with Batman Begins and works its way through. What would you say are some of the overarching things? Why would a Catholic, for example, want to or benefit from or find value in spending the time to work through the trilogy? You're going to put in about 6 hours, maybe a little bit more, to get through it all. What's sort of the value there? What's the value proposition there?
Yeah, again, aside from their, intrinsic entertainment value, but of course everyone's entertainment, aesthetics are different. But I think the overall message, especially from a Catholic perspective, is, the difference between justice and revenge and how to reconcile, again, these kind of, dueling aspects of our own inner natures. St. Paul talks about, there being a war within my members, and Augustine talks in his Confessions a lot about, how he's being pulled in different directions from different parts of his psyche. And, it's sort of a classic of philosophy, going back to Socrates, that happiness is harmony in one's soul, a balance of one's passions, one's desires, control of one's reason. And then, of course, from the Christian perspective, we also yield or require the grace of God to help us to keep our souls in balance. And throughout the Dark Knight series, you have various characters who, for various reasons, you know, their souls are in torment, and they're being pulled, just as I was describing, you know, Batman a little bit ago, kind of being pulled in one direction by their passion, by their anger or their despair or their sense of loss. But then there's the principled side of their nature. It's like, I shouldn't act this way. And which side of those is going to win out? And that's definitely a theme throughout, you know, all three films. Really, you know, a message about, like I said, the greater society and, you know, human beings in our sort of fallen nature, are we inclined to turn on each other, you know, when the chips are down or when we're facing some sort of moral dilemma? Or can a simple act of compassion, I love the scene in the end of The Dark Knight Rises where Batman is talking to Commissioner Gordon, who, when, you know, Batman as Bruce Wayne, when he was a young boy and his parents were killed, then policeman Gordon, you know, did a simple thing, you know, brought him a hot chocolate, put his jacket around him, and just kind of reassured him that although he suffered this tragedy, his world wasn't coming to an end. And Batman reminds him of that, you know, that many years later, and says, you know, that's, you know, being a hero. You know, just that little act of compassion to a small boy who's suffering. That's just one of my favorite moments, and I think it's, again, resonates with us. You know, even in the midst of utter despair and darkness, there's a room for God's love to break through in just the smallest of human action.
We're coming up on a break, but you mentioned something in there, and that is sort of the nature of society, that that we live in a fallen world, and the way Christopher Nolan casts that, particularly in the Batman trilogy, is something we'll want to take up. But we got to take a quick break, so when we come back, we'll talk a little bit more with Dr. Jason Eberle about pop culture and particularly the Batman Begins film series.
Think of all the media our young people are exposed to today. MTV, movies, what passes for entertainment on TV, song lyrics that are questionable or worse. Where do they hear the message that it's okay to be chaste and modest, or that it's not crazy to practice their faith, or to believe in a God who loves them and can forgive them no matter what they do? Catholic Radio is the answer. Be sure to tell your friends and relatives about the positive programming that you hear here on Catholic Radio.
Welcome back to the Catholic Cave. I am still Mark Tuttle, and I am
excellent. And since we've talked about identity crises,
exactly. Yep, exactly. Yeah, we've been talking.
I'm Jason Eberle. Wait, no. I'm Timothy O'Donnell.
Right.
Right.
But we were talking with Dr. Jason Eberle, professor of healthcare ethics at St. Louis University, and we've been talking a little bit about pop culture, particularly about Christopher Nolan films. And we talked a little bit about the question of identity that comes up, particularly in the Dark Knight series, the Batman Begins. So Christopher Nolan's cast on Batman. But you had brought up the Christopher Nolan's view of society, kind of what society looks like and how he portrays and casts society through the lens of the Batman story. So I thought I would ask a little bit about that. What kind of highlights can you bring out of Christopher Nolan's sort of social view that comes out through these films?
Yeah, so in each film, there's definitely some commentary on, you know, the nature of human beings in society and sort of the precariousness of large social structures. So, for example, in Batman Begins, you have these gangster criminals who basically run Gotham from behind the scenes, and you know, Bruce Wayne comes in, and he's wealthy, his family's had a lot of influence on the city, yet he walks into like the lair, this bar where the main gangster boss hangs out, and he's like, I don't care that you're Bruce Wayne. I could shoot you right now, and nothing will happen to me. I got a, you know, a police commissioner sitting over there. I got a judge sitting over there. I got so-and-so over there. You know, he's bought and paid off all of these officials. So, you know, definitely a very bleak view of a society, you know, full of corruption. And the idea is that the criminals can just act with impunity.
You know,
Go ahead.
I was going to say, one of the issues that brings up is a predominant theme, and that's the relationship between law and morality. That, you know, you've got a Batman character that, to a great extent, he himself is above the law. And yet you also have the criminal element that they're above the law. The law is, to a certain extent, impotent, but yet it exists. I mean, it's part of the story and part of society as well. So that relationship between, I think, being above the law but not quite lawless is another, like, huge theme that he draws out.
Yeah, so that's exactly right. And, you know, in The Dark Knight, there's this really interesting conversation between Bruce Wayne and Rachel, and Rachel's boyfriend, Harvey Dent, who's the district attorney for Gotham City. You know, he's trying to pull these criminals behind bars. And he talks about, you know, how, you know, going back to the old Roman Republic, you know, when the enemy's at the gates, they would suspend democracy and, you know, appoint, you know, a single leader to bring, you know, to safeguard the city, bring peace. And of course, you know, Julius Caesar and so on. And, you know, that doesn't always work out that well. And so,
right.
You know, one of the questions is, could there be such a virtuous, you know, single leader, or even if we can't really trust each other, which is, I think, one of Nolan's ideas, is, you know, democratic life still the better life with all its flaws?
Yeah, there's also, there seems to be different typologies, too, that kind of run throughout his films. Maybe let's pivot a little bit to a different film, one that I thought was really fascinating, which was Interstellar. Are you familiar with that one?
Oh, yes. Love that movie.
So maybe sketch out, if you would, just maybe a quick little kind of plot summary for our listeners who haven't seen Interstellar.
Oh, wow. That'd be a big
one. I mean... It is a deep, deep movie.
Yeah. But, I mean, in brief, the basic idea is, you know, in the near future, the Earth is blighted. You know, plagues have wiped out most of our food supply. The planet's arid. And there's, you know, not much more hope for humanity to live on this planet. But there's, through a wormhole, we're able to access other potentially habitable worlds. And some scientists have been sent out ahead to see if they truly are habitable. And so a follow-up mission is now happening to see if we can either transplant humanity to one of these planets, or as a backup, they take a bunch of embryos with them to potentially restart the human species on another planet if there truly is no hope for those, you know, left behind on Earth itself. And then there's some time travel stuff, and it gets really weird really quick.
Yeah, it sure does. I mean, I had to watch it a couple of times just to kind of soak it all in. His other film, another film of his that I had a similar kind of experience with was Inception, where you begin to experience this, you know, dream within a dream within a dream. Kind of phenomenon, and I found both of them at different points kind of disorienting, to be honest with you. And I was kind of like clutching the arms of my chair, you know, at the theater, because I'm like, I think I'm getting dizzy, you know, from all the plot turns. I mean, and the depth of these films are just remarkable. I think too, they're the kind his work that I've seen has had. An enduring value in that there's so many layers to it that you can watch them again and again and again, kind of like a great novel, right? Where every time you read it, you're able to, you know, you're able to sort of mine and go a little bit deeper and pick up on kind of new things and kind of make new connections. And they even strike you. I went back and watched his Batman trilogy again. You know, it had been almost 10 years, I think, since the first one had come out. and I'm in a different place, you know what I mean, myself. And so just kind of so that his themes can kind of hit you differently at different points in time as you sort of, you know, assuming, well, I don't think I've grown much, according to Mark. I'm fairly morally stagnant, I think. That's from living in the cave, I think, too much. But I really do find his work, Christopher Nolan's work, really exceptional. Plus, correct me if I'm wrong, Dr. Eberle, but from what I can tell, he's a writer, he's a producer, and he's a director on many, 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 if not the majority of his projects.
Oh, yeah. So some of his projects, he's literally a one-man show, writer, producer, director. Some things he co-writes with his brother, Jonathan Nolan, who's now gained fame, even more fame in his own right with his wife, Lisa Joy. They created the series Westworld on HBO.
Oh, love Westworld. We might have to talk a little bit about that.
And I have to say, I'm not shocked to see that there's a Christopher Nolan connection to Westworld at all.
No, I didn't realize that, but it makes total sense now that I've seen that. Oh, man.
Yeah, I recently wrote an essay for a book on Westworld and philosophy. And it was on whether Westworld can create or corrupt virtue.
Oh, wow.
Right.
Has that been published yet, or is that still forthcoming?
Yeah, no, that book is out. Came out earlier this year, available on Amazon.
Okay, Mark, take a note. That'll fit nicely in my stocking.
Well, let me ask you, because, you know, Westworld, it's got kind of a old Western set, but it really is a science fiction film or science fiction series, I guess.
Oh yeah.
And then, you know, obviously Interstellar, Memento, Inception, all of these are science fiction type of novels. So taking a step back a little bit from Christopher Nolan, particularly, what is it about the genre of sci-fi that allows some of this philosophical exploration to go on?
Oh, great question. So Ray Bradbury famously said that science fiction is the last realm where the philosopher can roam just as freely as he chooses. And the reason why he said that, and also what's inspiring your question, is the thing about science fiction is you can imagine alternate realities. And so much of these major moral issues, metaphysical dilemmas, and so on that you know, philosophers like to investigate, and even, you know, non-professional philosophers. Everyone's sort of an armchair philosopher, right, especially at the bar and coffee shop. And so everyone's got their theories about these things. People do, you know, like to think about them generally when they have time. You know, a lot of students start philosophy class like, oh, this is giving me a headache. And by the end, they're like, oh, wow, that was really interesting. But the thing is science, you know, to deal with these questions, we have sort of our intuitive responses, our responses that are sort of shaped by our everyday life, by our relationships, our emotional reactions, the values we were raised with. And sometimes it's just good to step out of that and say, okay, here's a slightly different twist. It's enough like reality that you can relate to it, but it's slightly different, and it challenges our intuition. Where, you know, you know, who you thought was the hero actually becomes the villain, or vice versa. And not to, you know, and sometimes it creates just a sense of moral ambiguity. That's not always a good thing, obviously, but sometimes it is good to stop and say, okay, I really thought I knew.
Well, Dr. Eberle, philosophy kind of cut its teeth on stories like that to a certain extent. So you've got the Ring of Gyges from Plato, where, you know, the questions posed, you know, if you could have an invisibility ring, you know, how would that affect you? You've got you know, the cave. You've got other sort of alternate reality settings that have been put there really since the very beginnings of philosophy. So is science fiction just sort of a continuation of that tradition?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. You know, Ray Bradbury famously said that science fiction is the last realm where the philosopher can roam as freely as he chooses. And I think the reason why he said that, and of course what's prompting your question, is that, you know, everyone's kind of an intuitive philosopher, right? Everyone's sort of an armchair philosopher. And, you know, people in general, are concerned about these questions of morality, and even, you know, kind of intrigued by these different metaphysical puzzles of, you know, personal identity, and, you know, obviously a question of, you know, whether there's a God and what is God like, and is there life after death, things of that nature. And, you know, we all come at these questions with our own, like I said, sort of intuitive biases, you know, the values that we bring to it, the way we're raised, our own, you know, unique perspective shaped by our histories. And sometimes it's good to step out of that and to kind of see things through a new lens. And so science fiction is a great way of taking something that is familiar enough, or it has to be close enough to reality, we can relate to it as a piece of drama or a piece of literature, but then it just twists things a little bit, turns things a little bit on their head, and make us kind of go, okay, so I thought I knew what the right thing, you know, to do was. I thought this was the hero character and that what they were doing is the right thing, but now I'm not sure. Maybe the villain is really the hero. And
well, yeah, I was going to say, the picking up on that theme, it seemed, would you say one of the trends in maybe pop culture overall is it seemed that the villain really does become sort of the person we most relate to, or the person we side with? It seems to me like there's especially in some of these superhero type films, there's no longer sort of like a pristine good guy who's wearing the white hat, you know, exactly where he stands, the Marshall Dillon, you know, of uncompromising moral code, but rather all of the characters are compromised morally to some extent, which gives the films kind of a darker, edgier feel to them, which seems to work really well at the box office. But I'm wondering, from a more philosophically moral standpoint, you know, is that the direction that these things seem to be heading? Am I picking up on something there? And if so, what might be some of the implications if all of our, because if our role models are all flawed or maybe terribly flawed?
Yeah, no, that is definitely, I think, a concern. But it's interesting. Like I said, it's sometimes good to challenge our moral or other preconceptions. But of course, you know, pure moral ambiguity is not necessarily a helpful thing. You
right.
Know, you know, and so on the one hand, I think having sort of the pure heroic character, we need some of those because we do need an exemplar, you know, to look up to. We need someone who we can say, okay, I want to be, you know, I want to be like Mike, right? The old expression.
A champion.
Yeah,
I want a champion,
right?
Yes.
On the other hand, of course, we all know about ourselves that we're not, you know, that is aspirational. And if someone is a little bit too perfect, they're just too pure, they might seem unreachable. You know, take, for example, the difference between, you know, Thomas Aquinas, the angelic doctor, right? He's someone I look up to as an intellectual inspiration, as a scholar. But he's almost, when you read his biographies, I mean, he's, I'm sure he felt himself to be a great sinner and had sins to confess, but at least from what we know of him historically, he doesn't really come across very much. He seems like this, you know, he's called the angelic doctor for a reason, right?
Right.
Yeah, you do kind of wonder what he had to bring up in the confessional. You know, when he went to
exactly.
confessional, what kinds of things did he confess?
Yeah, I read my breviary a little bit fast this morning.
Right.
Exactly.
I got a little twerked when someone took my spot.
Right.
You know, on the.
Well, you know, with fiction. Oh, go ahead.
Just to finish the thought, where St. Augustine, by contrast, who was so, you know, forthright in his confessions about the depth of his own sin and so on, just seems to be a much more relatable saint in that regard.
Yeah. Well, I also sometimes wonder if this age of the anti-hero that we're in, I mean, because especially when you look at some of the series that are, you know, being streamed online, House of Cards, Game of Thrones, those types of things. There are no good guys in those. I mean, those series are almost completely about villains and anti-heroes. Is this a case of kind of fiction and science fiction and pop culture catching up with G.E.M. Anscombe, who you know, kind of famously said, you know, all moral philosophers since Sidgwick show a sign of a deviant mind. You know,
oh
that,
my.
That, yeah, well, and her thought behind that is that, you know, the very act of questioning morality involves trying to find out where you can break the rules and where the rules no longer apply, and therefore, you know, a kind of case where moral theory just is not binding on us anymore, and that's kind of become the vocation of moral philosophy, is finding out how it doesn't apply to us anymore. Is that kind of what fiction's up to a certain extent with these series and things, of trying to kind of show how well the rules and the laws just no longer apply to us?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that is definitely, you know, earlier you drew the distinction between, you know, law and morality in the Batman series, and yeah, that's very much the setting of a lot of contemporary television, where, yeah, either you have someone who is, again, outside the law or above the law, or in the case of something like The Walking Dead, there's no society anymore for there to be laws, right? And so people have to make up their own rules and their own sense of morality. And I guess the question is, in at least a good anti-hero genre, and I think The Walking Dead is actually a pretty good example of this, with someone like Rick Grimes, where... Mm-hmm. You know, he's a flawed man like anyone else, but, you know, he has his own sense of morality. He has his own code that he lives by. That, I mean, does evolve throughout the series, as it does for other characters. And again, with Batman, right, the Joker challenges him, but yet, you know, he's not going to break his one absolute rule of not to intentionally kill someone. So the idea is that, I think, yes, there is this this reflection of a certain trend in society towards saying, yeah, the rules don't apply, everything's subjective, it's just about getting ahead. But then, again, the anti-hero still has to be a hero to some extent. And I think that's what makes them appealing, is all of them have some sort of incipient sense of morality, right? Aquinas would say you can't escape the pull of conscience, right? You can't escape the natural law that's written on our minds and hearts. And so even if you have someone who's very flawed morally and seems to be writing their own morality, there's still some sort of conscientiousness behind their actions. Otherwise, they would just be a pure villain and not an anti-hero.
And there does seem to be... That's an excellent point, Dr. Eberl. There does seem to be, you know, different... examples of virtues that are going on. For example, even with antiheroes, because no one really applauds the coward, right? So, you know, so even the anti-villain, even the villains have to demonstrate a certain kind of intestinal fortitude, even if their project is at the end evil, but at least they're not cowardly about it, right? So there's a variety of different ways in which you see virtue on display, and that even virtue in a what may be on balance a bad moral character is still attractive to us to at least see how it unfolds.
Yeah, the prime example of that I see are the Godfather movies. Yeah, you know, you watch those Godfather movies, and yeah, I mean, these are villains; these are really, really bad guys, but they're very admirable bad guys.
They're fascinating characters. I love the Godfather, the trilogy there.
I mean, all these examples, though, and the point you just made, Tim, do raise this interesting question for scholars of virtue theory, which is, what is the relation among the virtues? For some theorists, the virtues, they all hang together, in the sense that if you only have some, like, say if you have the virtue of courage, but you're employing it in a fashion that's not informed, say, by the virtue of justice or the virtue of charity, then you're not really courageous. It's an ersatz virtue. You know, yes, you're displaying, you know, control of your fears in face of danger, which seems to be the basic definition of courage, but it also has to be in service of a good end. Now, other theorists disagree with that and would say, no, the virtues don't all hang together. You can have some virtues and lack other virtues. You can have a mix of virtues and vices. So it's a very interesting question. which I don't have an answer to.
Are all of these instances in pop culture to a certain extent, you're right. I think these are a play with virtue. Is this a sign that our society is kind of moving to understanding morality and ethics a little bit more in terms of virtue and a little bit less in terms of, you know, consequentialism or some other ethical system?
I think definitely, and to go back, you know, to Nolan's film, a large number of his films where moral dilemmas do arise, the consequential, there's a temptation to a consequentialist or utilitarian outcome, but that's always the one that's on the bad guy's side. I shouldn't say that, not completely. So I'll give you two examples real quick from Nolan's films. So in Interstellar, you have the question of whether to act to keep the human race going or to act in a way to save those who are left behind, which includes, you know, those, you know, Matthew McConaughey's, the main character, his daughter, right, and others left on Earth, that his love for her, he can't leave her behind. He is going to go back to her, even if it's just for him to die with her of starvation, right? So that bond of love, that virtue that comes, you know, of the parent, you know, sacrificing everything for the sake of their child, even if it's ultimately in vain, right? Again, contrasted with the utilitarian pole to say, well, we can't save those on Earth. Let's go take these embryos and restart the human race. That's the best we can do. Another example in The Dark Knight. So you have Harvey Dent's character who becomes Two-Face after he's horribly burned and in the same incident where Rachel's killed. And he turns into this, you know, evil character. Now, he was someone very much held up as a virtuous person, Gotham's White Knight, the district attorney who was putting the criminals, you know, behind, and he didn't have to wear a mask to do it like Batman. Well, after he becomes Two-Face, he ends up, you know, going on a revenge spree, killing people, and Batman and Commissioner Gordon have to cover up what he did after Harvey Dent is killed. They have to say the people can't know that he had fallen. Otherwise, the Joker wins. So they create what Plato called the noble lie, right? They're going to deceive the people for the sake of benefiting the people because they need a hero like that. But it's a hero who's completely fabricated, right? It's based on a lie. Mm-hmm.
So we're going to be running out of time here, just a few minutes here. We've been speaking with Dr. Jason Eberle. He's the professor of healthcare ethics at St. Louis University. And we've been talking about pop culture. I want to turn our conversation maybe a little bit forward-looking towards I'm going to put you on the spot a little bit as sort of prognosticator. So if you were to look into the future, say 12 months or 24 months, you know, what sort of films might we anticipate and what sort of themes do you think might emerge in some of the upcoming films that you're aware of?
Okay. Can I take the break to cogitate on that?
Sure.
That's a big question.
Okay. Sounds good. We'll take a break and we'll be back with more of The Catholic Cave right after this.
You're listening to Catholic Radio Indy, converting the culture to Christ through radio, featuring 100% Catholic programming 24/7. Do your friends a favor. Tell them about Catholic Radio Indy.
Have you ever thought about joining the Catholic Church? Have you just wanted to explore the Catholic faith? All you need to do is call your local Catholic Church for more information. We are always happy to help you in your journey to discover and learn more about the Catholic faith. We have classes that are almost year-round, and the classes and information sessions do not involve making a commitment, and there is no pressure to join. Please call your local Catholic parish for more information today and start the journey of one day possibly becoming Catholic as well. God bless.
Welcome back to the Catholic Cave. We're still in the cave with us is Dr. Jason Eberle of St. Louis University, professor of healthcare ethics. And right before the break, Dr. Eberle, I turned this question out to you about let's be a little forward looking and what do you see on the horizon in terms of upcoming films and maybe any themes that how the films may have and how they may impact the culture?
Yeah, that's a great question and obviously a bit difficult to answer, but you know, going back to a point that Mark made earlier, the kind of rise of the anti-hero and a lot of these very dark dystopian types of stories, I think the envelope's been pushed to the edge of what it can do with going like, you know, really super dark and dreary and anti-hero, because you look at, for example, what's happened with the DC comic movie. Mm. You know, when Man of Steel came out, and then after that, Batman versus Superman and Justice League, you know, people didn't like the portrayal of Superman, not because the actor was necessarily doing a bad job, but because he was written as more a flawed character. And again, he was, you know, truth, justice in the American way, right? You know, back in the old 30s comic,
right?
And throughout the, you know, Christopher Reeve films and so on, you know, if there was ever like the sort of, as you said earlier, the white hat superhero, he, you know, Superman was it, or the red caped one, and you know, because Batman was always kind of this, you know, more darker, flawed character, but you know, those movies have, you know, not gotten a great reception. I mean, they're objectively, honestly, not as good as the Marvel films, in my opinion, but. You know, the Marvel films, although they have their darker, dramatic elements, I mean, Infinity War, of course, but nevertheless, there's still, you know, the characters are, you know, they're really likable characters, most of them.
Yeah, I love Guardians of the Galaxy, that whole ensemble of characters is, I think one of the contrasts, too, is that with the Avengers, they make a much better use of comedy and humor, where mm-hmm. in the DC series, there's very little comedy or humor that comes through, and their use of say satire and irony is often a little, I don't know, it's kind of dark, So you kind of walk out of there kind of like emotionally, I don't know, I don't say drained, but I'm more pessimistic about my worldview has just gotten a couple of shades darker than it was when I walked in. And that's not necessarily, you know, a bad thing when it comes to seeing, say, dramas and things like that. But I definitely come out of like an Avenger movie with a little more pep in my step.
Yeah, and I think people need that. You know, I won't make any overt political comments, but certainly the culture in America and really the world over today is a little bit bleaker maybe than it was a few years ago. And, you know, there's a lot of anger out there. And people, you know, again, entertainment, first of all, should just be that, entertaining. It obviously can also be thought-provoking, which is something I enjoy about entertainment. I like being kind of forced to think about things with my entertainment, but it also needs to be entertaining. And when it's a little bit too like, oh wow, this is really like my real life, it's like, you know, doctors don't watch medical dramas, right?
Right.
Like, you know, cops don't watch cop shows.
Right.
So I think we're maybe needing to see maybe a turnaround, and probably a good example of this was the last Star Wars movie, not Solo, but The Last Jedi, right? The last saga.
Oh, yes, yes.
Where, you know, people really, you know, did not like, you know, what they did with Luke's character, the overall, again, darker aspects of the story, which, you know, go back to Empire Strikes Back, everyone loved that was a darker, more serious film. Mm-hmm. But now with the Episode 9 back in the hands of J.J. Abrams, I think, you know, the Lucasfilm, the Disney studios are kind of like, okay, we need to get back to something that's a little bit more just plain heroic, just plain good mm-hmm. versus evil, and good's going to triumph in the end, because it's the last of the saga films, right?
Right.
I'm sure keep making more Star Wars types films, but, you know, this is going to be the end of the Skywalker legacy, and if it doesn't end with, you know, little Ewoks dancing everywhere, everyone's just going to be depressed.
it better not end with Ewoks dancing everywhere.
I did really enjoy. You're right. That franchise is huge. There's going to be all kinds of Star Wars stuff for the foreseeable future. And I really did enjoy Solo, though, as another kind of like a reboot. I thought they did a really marvelous job with that. With he's such a great character, and the the storyline was wonderful. The acting was good all the way through too.
And they cast him in a more heroic light in a lot of ways than the original, you know, first three Star Wars movies did. I mean, he was a much more of a white good guy, you know, white hat wearing type of character than the original series portrayed him.
That's true, and I like Solo as well. Of course, it didn't do very well at the box office. I mean, it did well objectively speaking, but not relative to what Star Wars movies are expected to do.
Right.
So if it was any other movie, it would have been like, oh, this is a great success. But because it's as a Star Wars movie, it should have done so much better than it did. It actually was considered a failure by Disney. And I wonder if some of that is related to this idea that, I think that Alden Ehrenreich, who played Han Solo, I think he did a great job. And I think they did. It was a fun romp of a film, you know. It was a
right.
buddy comedy and a heist movie. But, yeah, even though he's an outlaw, he's not really, yeah, you kind of expect a Han Solo to have this even darker past from, as you're saying, Mark, from the original. You know, Han Solo just adds more, such maturity and gravitas to the role, even when he was, only in his mid-30s. He felt like an older man in this role, and he felt like, this guy's got a past. This guy's got something interesting. And I don't know if Solo really gave an entertaining backstory, but I don't know if it gave as rich a backstory as maybe fans were hoping for.
Yeah, I did appreciate the way with Solo and Rogue One, though, were able to sort of shoehorn the storyline into the broad and make the connections to the already existing story arc of Star Wars and fill in some of. There was a lot more that could have been done, but I do think they did a nice job of sort of knitting together this piece of cloth to the broader tapestry. Oh, did you look at that? What an analogy I just had. Mark, what do you think?
Well,
he's looking at me cross-eyed. Yeah. You can't see that on the radio. But he's like, what the heck? Does he even know what he's saying half the time? I don't think he does. He gave me one of those looks. Dr. Yeah. Eberl.
Well, we'll have to see where the series winds up in the end, Tim. But but no, I do. Going back to the broader question about where we're going in exploring moral virtue through film and all of that, I do wonder if I guess the sense of moral virtue, it's being tested by a lot of these films. And so the question is, where will our sense of virtue come out in the end of that as a culture? Are we going to keep going? You know, one of the, I think one of the sort of jokers in the mix is the film Deadpool. We're coming close to the end of our show, so I don't really want to bring up a whole new topic, but right. the sort of reluctant hero, the everyday hero that is heroism is kind of thrust upon them unwillingly. Mm-hmm. That seems to be a direction that some of these films are going.
Yeah, no, and again, I think that ties into, you know, a desire on the audience's part for the hero to be somewhat relatable to them. Like, oh, hey, I don't have a cape. I'm not an alien from Krypton or anything, and I don't have millions of dollars like Bruce Wayne, but maybe I too can be a hero, even though I can also be, you know, kind of a jerk sometimes. You know, even jerks can be heroes.
I can relate to that.
Well, yeah, I think that was the subtitle of Augustine's Confession.
Boy, that is required reading. Boy, if anyone listening has not had the opportunity to make their way through St. Augustine's Confessions, we definitely got to do that. And I think with that book recommendation, that's all the time we have today in the Catholic Cave. You've been listening to Mark Tuttle, Timothy O'Donnell, Kent Blanford, and our special, I don't want to say guest, he's our frequent...
He's an honorary caveman, yeah.
Honorary caveman. Harry Palms and all, professor of healthcare ethics, Dr. Jason Eberl at St. Louis University. Thank you again, Dr. Eberl, so much for coming back into the Catholic Cave.
Thank you always. Yes, thank you.
All right, and that is it for the Catholic Cave for this week. We'll catch you next week, and until then, may God bless.
The Catholic Cave is a production of Catholic Radio Indy. Replays of this program are available in podcast form at CatholicRadioIndy.org. Comments about this program can be addressed to kent@catholicradioindy.org or by calling 317-870-8400.
Did you miss something in this show or just want to hear it again? Podcasts of this and all our other great local programs are available 24/7 at catholicradioindy.org.